Well, thank you very much for all of you for showing up on Saturday morning, and I'd like to send my thanks to the sponsors for this symposium. It really has been a very remarkable experience listening to speakers so far, and for David and Judy and Al for the organizing efforts, and especially to Al for inviting me to be a part of this session. It's always a great honor to be asked to be a speaker at one of these, and particularly a great honor when you're asked to step outside the comfort of your immediate research area. It's such an honor that it sort of preempts common good sense when you say yes and then suddenly ask, what have I gotten myself into? Before I get very far along, I probably ought to respond to the Chagas disease question or comment from last evening. Theoretically, I guess, depending on how Darwin may have been embalmed, and I don't know that, it might be possible to dig the guy up and probe for some DNA sequences like have been done on Chilean mummies to discover that Chagas disease has been in the New World for thousands upon thousands of years. Epidemiologically, it's absolutely a legitimate guess that he may be contracted Chagas disease. The tritone vectors are really common throughout all of Latin America, and they feed rather unmercifully on any mammal they can get close to. I personally have never been convinced that the pathology described of Darwin's illnesses, that according to at least the books that I've read, began before the Beagle left port. And as a result, I've never found the Chagas comments to be particularly convincing. In fact, he probably should have died along quite a bit sooner than he did. Okay, Joy, I'm going to try to get my stuff going. I do have a show. Here we go. Well, needless to say, if you're an invertebrate zoologist and somebody says to you, like Al did to me, we'd like for you to speak at a session involving literature and poetry and in an evolution topic, the words poetry and evolution said together to a person with my background produce immediately the third word, which is Garstang, Walter Garstang, because we grew up really on Garstang's what was called poetry at the time. Knowing I'd be in the company of people from the Department of English, however, in the title I changed that to doggerel out of respect for real poetry. Walter Garstang was a marine biologist working out of the lab at Plymouth, and he studied for his entire career life cycles. He studied embryological development of a whole variety of invertebrates, studied natural history of mollusks, crabs, and he eventually started actually offering 2 or 3 day classes over Easter to local folks, and that was the start of the grand tradition of biological field stations as learning environments for biologists. He's really the source of what we call the Garstang hypothesis of the origin of chordates, and of course the origin of chordates, which includes the origin of us, has always been a prime concern long before Darwin. I'll show you some pictures in a moment of the Garstang hypothesis, and I want to talk a little bit about his doggerel and how it sustained, where it came from, and how it sustained the idea of neoteny or pedomorphosis as a phylogenetic event. I think it's important to remember that this poetry was really the product of a gentleman who was simply a fun-loving guy and a little bit of a cut-up his whole life, and devised ways to to help his students remember biology. And one of the ways that he helped, tried to help his students remember biology was with this, these poems, which in many ways were mnemonics. So this morning, what I'm going to do is run through a list of topics fairly quickly, most of which could occupy at least a semester's, if not a whole year's course, and several doctoral dissertations. So they're going to get about 3 minutes apiece. I want to pick out one example of some pre-Victorian natural history poetry, talk a little bit about the narrative structure of some of this post-Darwinian literature, talk about the origin and phylogeny of chordates from Walter Garstang's point of view. I'll eventually get to the impossible experiments and talk then really about communication of big ideas, and finish up with Charles Darwin's own advice to graduate students, who I'm sure there are none in the audience, but I tell my own graduate students that same advice all the time, and it's not clear that they really listen very much. There is a massive natural history literature, as I'm sure all of you know. The thing that I'd like to point out about this literature from the perspective of a biologist, the good stuff, and quite frankly, Erasmus Darwin's successful efforts to translate Systema Naturae, Linnaeus's classic and highly influential and pivotal work, to translate that into English, is a good example of that. But of course, Erasmus Darwin, who was a very remarkable individual in his own right, multi-talented, high-living guy who sired 14 children, at least a couple of them by mistresses, nevertheless had an eye for plant reproduction, and he had a real talent for converting that eye into a form of literature. And the point with this stuff, this is actually about poppies, and I happened to pick it out just because it seemed like the first one, or first page of this that I read that seemed to serve the need. And the need here, for this morning at least, is to legitimatize this stuff biologically, so that asphodels, both asphodelus and amaranthus, of course, are genera of fairly common herbaceous plants. Particularly amaranthus is that genus, and that plant has been used in literature over and over and over again, largely as a symbol for longevity. These papaver are the poppies, and everybody knows that poppies are the source of opium. And I read this stuff down here: froze by enchantment on the velvet ground, fair youths and beauteous ladies glitter round. On crystal pedestals they seem to sigh, bend the stiff knee and lift the unmoving eye. That sounds like an opium-induced high to me, particularly for younger people who haven't really experienced a lifetime of drug addiction and the deterioration that goes with it. So all of this stuff is very legitimate, and it's legitimate biology, but it also it tells a story about biological phenomena that is very memorable, or it tells it not in a you learn this for the next exam sort of a way, but in a romantic, in an emotional, in an interpersonal kind of way that can be rather extraordinarily effective as a teaching device. In fact, I thought many times that if I were assigned to teach a course in botany, not knowing very much at all about botany, but having bought Randy Moore's botany book early on, I might just get out all of Erasmus Darwin's poetry and assign that as the text and go through it line by line, picking out all the generic names, asking what's the biology behind his use of this particular stuff. And I think you might end up with a pretty interesting course. For those of you that don't know me very well, I tend to also, when it comes to the word literature, I tend to sort of merge real literature and poetry and nonfiction and fiction and art and music and architecture and design, all of this stuff into sort of a general literature in which we recognize that there is a grammar, there is a lexicon, there are rules of assembling narrative in all of these domains. So I'm going to skip now from Erasmus Darwin up to some of the post-Darwinian architects. And this material really comes from a book that I picked up in an art museum bookstore. Let me find it right here. Stephen Eisenman's, and I would recommend this one to you. It's actually a catalog of an exhibition that was held in the Art Museum of Northwestern University entitled Design in the Age of Darwin, from William Morris to Frank Lloyd Wright. Well, William Morris, of course, was one of the truly influential architects in the 19th century British architects. But this entire volume is what I would call a good summary of the use of biological materials in everyday life, and particularly in the last half of the 19th century and early parts of the 20th century. Keep in mind that when you put wallpaper on your dining room wall, then you're going to look at that stuff every day. And if you work in a building, say a high-rise designed by Lewis Sullivan, who was, again, one of the top architectural figures in this country during the first part of the 20th century, that you see those forms, those biological forms, every single day of your life. And so the nature of those forms, the extent to which they obey real biology, is fairly critical. So here's a good example of this, and I don't know if you can see that from out there. Owen Jones is also one of the really profoundly important and influential British architects. And this book of his called The Grammar of Ornament, it was really served as a piece of literature that directed the internal environments to which people adapted culturally and emotionally. And I think the phrase, the grammar of ornament, and this is a particularly some work of Christopher Dresser, who was internal designer also in the 19th century in Britain. But when you look at this plant material, it's not very stylized. It's pretty much the kind of thing that you could, in fact, use almost in a textbook. So the whole idea of design using legitimate figures, legitimate imagery, interpreted as a grammar. These are your words. These are how you assemble these words to make an environment for an individual to live in. I think this is sort of an example of the permeation of natural history. permeation of what we would call real natural history into everyday life. It also, even more importantly though, I think what Darwin did for architecture and internal design in the last half of the 1800s was redefine the words adaptation, redefine the word function, redefine the word form, so that form, for example, by 18, the term form in a literary sense, when applied to a tangible object like this auditorium, was obviously a form that was made for a purpose and adapted to the people that worked there. So all those words took on a little bit different meaning than they had before. In commentary of the day, this is a review of a Lewis Sullivan piece, the Hooley Theater. I don't know if any of you have been in that building in Chicago, but at the time, in the 1880s, it was It was one of Lewis Sullivan's masterpieces. So this is kind of an architectural comment on some architecture. It's difficult to learn from Mr. Sullivan just what he's done. He refers to the work you will see about the stage opening as the differentiation of an absolute truth, something having to do with Spencer's first principles and Darwin's doctrine of evolution, with a predicate of the flower and ordinary staircase for a hypothesis. And I challenge you to go to the print media today and find a paragraph like that in your newspaper. Well, let me get on then and sort of continue with the idea of what we might call legitimate natural information as a part of the very general definition of literature. And this one I happened to pick up just because it arrived in my living room because of Karen, who subscribes to Art in America, of course. And this is a October last fall issue, the cover, really, of Art in America with Philip Taft's one of his paintings on it. And these things, well, it's an inverted result, just these things immediately, you know where they come from. They come from radiolarians and foraminiferans, all those shell oceanic amoebas. So this was really kind of a good excuse in trying to put together my comments for this morning. This was a good excuse to go back and pick up that information about Victorian architecture and Darwin's influence on it and tie it together to the gentleman that I really wanted to use as the stepping stone for Garstang, and that is Ernst Haeckel. So these are some of Haeckel's drawings of shelled amoebas. And whatever else he was, besides being a showman and a good scientist in some ways, he was also a truly superb draftsman, and in that sense, a truly superb artist. And furthermore, he was not only a clinical textbook artist. These are shelled amoebas gathered on the Challenger expedition, the Challenger voyage throughout the Mediterranean. Haeckel also, if you get into all of his drawings, the corals and some of the echinoderms, you realize that these things are arranged. They have a narrative of their own. They tell a story by means of their arrangement. And you would never see this kind of an arrangement in a modern textbook. What you see are scanning electron micrographs. So this is kind of the stepping stone to the idea that there are people who continually use natural imagery, real information about natural materials in cultural ways. And these range not only from the Lewis Sullivan and Owen Jones folks, but the guys like Philip Taft. Actually, all you have to do when you go out of here, walk back over to Andrews Hall, and there's Roxy Payne's stainless steel tree, which is also a good example of that. Well, now then, let me get quickly to Mr. Haeckel. He's best known for this simple phrase, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which is in itself a little bit of a summary of the so-called biogenetic law. There are a number of people, as all of you know, who became very enthusiastic evolutionists after 1859, and Ernst Haeckel was certainly one of them. His enthusiasm really knew no bounds, but in fact it knew so few bounds that he ultimately went beyond biology, went sort of beyond what the real biologists continued to tell him about comparative embryology. But in the process of his proselytizing, in the process of his what we might call his own intellectual evolution, which would probably be worthy of a real study. How does a person who's a legitimate young biologist grow into the Ernst Haeckel of his elder years? I think is a very good question. But he's most known, of course, for this diagram right here, which has survived in all kinds of contexts, most of them today from creationist websites who are trying to use it to, of course, debunk the theory of evolution. But this thing has enormous staying power, and you see some form of it even in current textbooks. Now, before I get into Garstang, remember that an invertebrate zoologist, particularly a marine invertebrate zoologist who studies life cycles and who studies development, learns very quickly that larval stages have their own diversity. Our students at Cedar Point, it takes them about one afternoon to get to this point from original experience. All you really have to do is go collect mosquito larvae, try to identify them as a pretense for learning to become a scientist who will study tropical disease. And you figure out in a hurry that different species of mosquitoes live in different places and they have different structures. And because we are so perfused, I would say, with evolutionary ideas, the instantaneous question is, well, are all these structural differences adaptations? Well, anybody who really studies life cycles gets to that question very quickly on their own, and Garstang was certainly no different in this regard. And so Garstang's contribution overall to his career is really the statement or the assertion that ontogeny does not, in fact, recapitulate phylogeny. What ontogeny does is create phylogeny and create evolutionary change. The organisms of interest, and I will get to this poetry here. The organisms of interest are, in his case, are tunicates, particularly larval stages. This is Ciona intestinalis, the one that's the darling of the molecular biologists even today. Here are some of the structures that are involved. These are prochordates. They have a notochord, statolith, an eye spot. They also have a pharynx. You can't see it very well on this, but they have a large bulbous pharyngeal region that has slits in it and a branchial siphon. So there's some sort of a preview of structural features of chordates. And Garstang then made his life, much of his life's work, studying these things. So here's a kind of a classic textbook diagram of Garstang's hypothesis, his contribution to evolutionary theory. And this hypothesis, this picture, derived mainly from Garstang's poetry, because his scientific papers are so difficult to read that it's almost impossible to get this kind of summary information out of them. So this stuff really comes from the doggerel, but its real source is Garstang's question about the adaptation, about the evolution of larval forms, the natural selection operating on larval forms of marine invertebrates. And this is directly attributable to all of that, and that's what you get out of his real scientific writings. And I would encourage any of you that if you're having trouble sleeping, go photocopy some of that stuff and get into it. So Garstang's hypothesis actually says that vertebrates arose, and the ostracoderms, of course, are some of the earliest reasonably large jawless vertebrates. These things arose by neoteny from the larval stages of these sessile tunicates or sea squirts. The idea here being that these things, the larval stages have structural features that all this thing would have to do would be to just simply get mature, grow gonads, and become an adult and retain that structure, and then we'd have a tiny little sort of vertebrate-like creature that would have the basic design of chordates. And so this whole idea is one that has some kind of remarkable staying power of its own. And this gets us then to his poetry. his daughter. May I call it poetry? I'm going to call it poetry. It's not, but I mean, certainly keep in mind that we're here this morning in the home of Pulitzer Prize winning poet, National Poet Laureate, who I think if Ted were able to sit down and go through this verse, he would enjoy the idea that it's called poetry. Nevertheless, and he wrote this stuff without it necessarily feeling, according to his biographers, and Alistair Hardy is one of them, but according to Garstang's biographers, then he never really worried too much about the stuff being published, and he always thought maybe, well, he'd publish it in a little while, publish it in a little while, but he never did until he died, and then Hardy put together all of those poems with some commentary about how they came about and where they came from. And so let's look at some of this stuff. Perhaps the most pervasive of these is the Ballad of the Beleaguer that gets repeated over and over and over again, simply because it has a little bit of a lesson. It's an easy way to remember what happens in gastropod and snail development early on. There are two major phases of snail development. One of them is where the shell early on in embryological development turns on the body. This is quite distinct from the later coiling. So anytime you pick up a snail and see it's coiled, either flat or spiral, that stuff all happens after this twisting on the body. So this is the series of embryological events that's common to really most mollusks. And the Ballad of the Beleaguer is nothing more than how the gastropod got its twist. The Beleaguer's a lively tar, the liveliest afloat, whirling wheel on either side propels his little boat. But when the danger signal warns his bustling submarine, he stops the engines, shuts the port, and drops below unseen. Actually sucks into the shell and falls down. Well, the port, the opening, then gets sealed up with the operculum. Later on, then, here is really the evolutionary part. A fleet of fry turned out one day, eventful in the sequel, whose head and foot retractors on the two sides were unequal. Their starboard halyards fixed astern ran only to the head, while those a port were set abeam and served the foot instead. So what we have here is a fleet of fry one day. This is production of offspring. This line is really production of offspring with genetic variability, indeed important genetic variability, the sequel here, referring to what's going to happen to these genetic variants. Here we have the first change or the mutation, which creates some lack of symmetry. And then the last two lines really tell what, you know, what the anatomical feature is that's going to produce this torsion. We get to the ancestry of the vertebrates. This is actually where I think that a case could be made. It could be discussed, it could be argued, but I think that this is, the next two poems are really what we might be able to trace back to the origins of this current really hot topic in our hot research area in biology called evolutionary developmental biology, or EvoDevo, and especially that focused on the origin of us. Gill slits, tongue bars, synapticuli, endostyle and notochord, all these you will agree, mark the protochordate from the fishes in the sea and tell alike them our lowly pedigree. So this is a common ancestor type of thinking. Thyroid, thymus, notochordal rod, these we share with lampreys, dogfish, and the cod. So this is, we would call these today plesiomorphic characters or primitive characters. And if we were doing constructing a morphological phylogeny, these things would be defining the basal characters. Relics of the food trap that served our early meals and tongue bars that multiply the primal water wheels. It gets really more interesting next. Well, oh, before I get to that, there's a fair amount of common or current molecular biology that deals with the genetic relationships between thyroid and some of the tunicate endostyles. And I think anatomically, when you watch the development of those features, the thyroid gland in vertebrates and the endostyle in tunicates, you're led very comfortably to equate those two, and the genetics folks are working hard to do that. And news, parabranchiate have gone from bad to worse. They think aquatic life is bliss, terrestrial a curse. They do not even contemplate a change to suit the weather, but live as tadpoles, breed as tadpoles on the go. So this is neoteny. This is the retention of larval forms with the acquisition of gonads. Now look at Amacete there, reclining in the mud, preparing thyroid extract to secure his tiny food. If just a touch of sunshine should make his gonads grow, the Lancelot's claim to ancestry would get a nasty blow. Well, the Amacetes are, of course, the larval forms of lampreys, which are true vertebrates. And this line right here, I don't know why, because Amacetes are filter feeders in freshwater streams. I don't know why he would use the phrase "the touch of sunshine," unless he also knew enough about, for example, birds, for whom day length is one of the primary factors, if not the primary factor, in producing gonad growth. The Lancelot's claim, this is Amphioxus, of course, and most of the current molecular work, I think, points to Amphioxus as our best example of a common ancestor. So this is where this stuff comes from. In addition to the poetry, however, and it's the poetry, really, that extended Garstang's reputation beyond the hard scientists of the time. Now, these two papers represent the hard science. One of these is this is the one right here, even though it came afterwards. This is the one that has all of the raw information. And this is a real slug to get through those 130 pages. This particular one is the one that finally, the theory recapitulation, the critical assessment, this is the one that finally, according to most historians, finally laid Ernst Haeckel's biogenetic law to rest. And this biogenetic law, as you might know, was really fairly important, if not very important, throughout most of the late 1800s and even into the early 1900s as a paradigm by which we studied evolution. Now, here's some of the vocabulary out of that, and that vocabulary is fairly remarkable. These are all of the sources of information that he drew on to legitimatize what we now know as heterochrony, or differences in the phasing of development as an evolutionary force, and focused really on adaptation to environments of larvae. Today, Garstang's hypothesis looks something like this, and some of you will recognize these abbreviations as the names of genes and genes families. So really among the leading questions of the day today are how is the brain constructed? Where are the realms of genetic expression that allow us to interpret this larval development? And so a modern version of Garstang looks something like this, and there's a lot of this kind of stuff. I just happened to pick one. So the previous vocabulary was pretty substantial. This vocabulary is equally as substantial. It just concerns a different set of phenomena. These are mainly genes. And instead of Garstang's hypothesis, the one in textbooks for decades, this is what this diagram now looks like. I'll finish by saying that regardless of how sophisticated the work is on evolution of body type, it's all still inferential. And it's quite opposed to things like the Grant study on Galapagos finches, or the well-known, that even Darwin used, the well-known production of types on purpose through natural selection in agriculture. And even, I flipped this one in just as an ode to parasitology a little bit. This is the sickle cell anemia gene that is always interpreted to be an adaptation to infection by malaria, but I'm always reminded of the really grand experiments in natural selection that surround malaria, and one of them being the introduction of chloroquine into the blood of American soldiers during Vietnam. And this, you know, this is nothing more than a massive evolutionary experiment involving natural selection. And the null hypothesis might be something like, if you give all American soldiers in Vietnam chloroquine every day for several years, then the parasites, malarial parasites, will not adapt. That would be your null hypothesis that's testable and absolutely rejected. And we know that those same testable hypotheses involving pesticides, DDT, and insects, I've done over and over again, and they work. So what's really happened is that over time, we've shown science, I say we, scientists have shown that undeniably that the process of selection, the processes of evolution, all of those processes that we now know about work. And there's no doubt that the demonstration of process is an accomplished fact. What I think very often troubles the public is that the outcome of that process doesn't really rest on the same kind of investigative tools and investigative strategy that the discovery of the process itself does. And so Alistair Hardy really nailed this. Of course, none of Garstang's speculations can ever be established by experiment. And this is key. They can never be proved as a hypothesis can in physiology. It is this, Garstang, with his concept of pedomorphosis, has altered our whole outlook on the process of evolution. And many, many times I think really that this, the nature of scientific investigation, the difference between a how question, which is a question of function, a question of process, and a why question, which you answer very largely by inference, is really at the heart of this nation's troubles with scientific literacy. And so if I had to characterize the so-called evolution-creation debate, I would say it's really, in many ways, a political debate that deals with science literacy. The same people who will watch CSI week after week after week may really not understand and not appreciate and not accept as legitimate science the way that every scientist does the inferential method of answering this question, what is the world really like? A couple of quick examples of what I would call serious nonfiction literature that ultimately will have a great deal more of an effect on our levels of science literacy than all of the scientific papers that most of us will publish in our lives. These are Elegant Lives of the Cell, perfused with evolutionary thinking. Alan Weisman's book, The Thought Experiment, What Happens If, is a legitimate investigative tool for the evolutionary process. These things are really communicating big ideas, and they represent today, I think, the power of literature to convey big ideas, the essay as a weapon, the extended essay as a weapon. And finally, my advice passed along to you from Mr. Darwin, and this is out of his autobiography as edited by Nora Barlow, If I had to live my life again, I would have made some rule to read poetry and listen to some music at least once every week. Perhaps the parts of my brain atrophied could have been kept active through parts of... Come on, give me a break. The loss of these tastes is a loss of happiness, that I might agree with, and may possibly be injurious to the intellect. Okay. And probably more to the moral character. I don't think so. By enfeebling the emotional parts of our nature. So this is Charles Darwin, and I think he probably could have gone back and read some of his grandfather's stuff every day. And would have taken care of that problem. Thank you very, very much.
You know, you can't read those Lives of the Plants very long.
No, I know.
Mean, heroic couplets just...
I know.
All that rhyming, it just gets to you.
I know.
How charming.
I know.
I've seen Michael Page, who wrote a whole long chapter on the Rising Sun.
Yeah.
Both those works are pre-evolution.
I would get to the point where, you know, reading through...